On This Week in Enterprise Tech, the FBI's PIN on FTP. The U.S. Congress may have given up on your privacy rights, but the states haven't. And everything you needed to know about bot-on-bot action with GupShup. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 233, recorded March 31st, 2017. Bot on bot action with GupShup. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by GoCD, an on-premise open-source continuous delivery server by ThoughtWorks. GoCD gives you complete control of and visibility into your deployments across multiple teams. Since GoCD is open-source, you can download and use it for free. To discover the power of their pipelines, visit gocd.io/twit. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasaire, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. But of course, I can't guide you by myself. It's a big old enterprise world, and I'm going to need a little help from my friends, starting with Mr. Lou Maresca. He is a senior lead developer over at Microsoft and, part of their financially gigantic dynamics department. Lou, my friend, good to see you. And, of course, good to see the hair.
It's great to be back. Yeah, and today's my son's fourth birthday, so we're going to have a little bit of a short day here at Microsoft and hopefully some sun.
Whoa, wait a minute. Microsoft takes a short day for your son's birthday? That is awesome.
Yeah, it's a holiday. You don't know?
that is a user satisfaction. Also joining us is Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, I think I just saw you a few days ago, did I not?
I was down at Enterprise Connect, and I think my blurry memories include at least one wild and crazy video shooter down on the floor, so that well could have been you.
Yes, and also I will say that I've made it, because in the early days of Enterprise Connect would be me with a camera roaming around the halls and the floor and trying to get coverage, and now they actually got me a booth, which is fun. Even though I still have to set it up myself. Well, folks, let's not talk about that, because we've got a full packed episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Not only do we need to talk a little bit about privacy, but we've got some bot on bot action. I'm going to let you try to figure out what that means. But first, let's go ahead and jump straight into the blips. Now, last Wednesday, the cyber division of the FBI issued a private industry notification, or PIN, informing the public that they are tracking active exploitation of unsecured FTP servers, particularly the ones that are linked to networks with access to protected health and personally identifiable information. The PIN referenced a 2015 University of Michigan study that cataloged more than 1 million FTP servers that were configured to allow for anonymous access. The cyber division has been watching an increase of attacks in which such FTP servers are either targeted for privilege escalation or used to store caches of exfiltrated data, exploit tools, and attack payloads. This PIN is unique in that it's addressing not a new exploit or previously unknown attack, but rather the forgotten cloud that is the vast network of plugged and forgotten FTP servers that many businesses don't even know they're still running. Their recommendations: turn off all anonymous authentications, move to more secure file transfer protocols, or if FTP is still essential, make it a standalone system that is not connected to a network with health or personally identifiable information.
Hey, IBM is investing bigly in a big hybrid cloud. Psst, hey, want to hear a secret? Even the cloud has to run on physical hardware. That's been both the saving grace and confounding legacy of traditional hardware companies looking into the vast, confusing morass of the future. While IBM has done well in the private cloud market, it's the public cloud that's growing, nearly double last year, with more growth on the way, according to recent reports from Synergy Research Group and other firms. John Considine, the general manager of IBM's cloud infrastructure business, sees private cloud as a stepping stone toward either a full public cloud plan or the hybrid model that many companies are embracing now. And that shift in computing requires hardware, lots of it. In addition to IBM's 50 current cloud data centers, Considine plans on making major investments, measured in the billions of dollars, in infrastructure throughout 2017 to support a number of different initiatives, including cognitive computing plans, artificial intelligence, and IaaS. IBM is looking at a future where the cloud forms the basis for several other technologies, including its much talked about cognitive computing, Watson, as well as AI, IoT, and the development of whole new sets of APIs to make these technologies work.
You've used Amazon, right? And they have pretty good customer service, don't you think? Well, Amazon has had over a decade of customer service interactions using a proprietary service stack that they've used internally, and they've actually decided it's time to share it with enterprises around the world with their new Amazon Connect Customer Contact Center. This particular space is quite crowded in the market, but with its built on, with this new solution from Amazon, it's actually built on AWS, could be a market disruptor. One base feature is the virtual contact center. The Amazon claims it can be set up in minutes, and it requires no special training to use. For the minutes that it's used on top of its telemetry system, you're charged by those minutes, and it's a per-use pricing model, just like AWS's cloud services. Another feature is the contact flow module, which actually uses data from an additional source like Amazon DynamoDB, Redshift, Amazon Aurora, and other third-party systems to alter the customer's experience. That same data can be used to build flows using Amazon's Lex to include natural language understanding and speech recognition, and allowing customers to simply say what they want instead of waiting to hear a bunch of menus and options. Connect's pricing is, like I said, a pay-as-you-go model, and while with a pricing differing from each type of call, country of origin, where the call is originated, it also has a free usage tier, which gives users 90 minutes of service usage, a direct inward number, or a DID, or a virtual number that enables calls to be routed, a toll-free number, a half an hour of inbound calls, and toll-free calls, as well as 30 minutes of outbound calls each month for a year. So the interesting part about this is what it's also offering is integration with its competitors in some sense, partnering with both Zoho, its help desk service company Zendesk, VoiceBase, and Freshdesk. This part of the tech industry seems like it's about to change as the customer service giant takes the wheel.
Oh, by the way, we should probably mention that Amazon AWS is a sponsor of TWiET.
Ford is driving into a $200 million data center. Ford is acting more and more like a cloud computing company these days, as opposed to the iconic car company of the last 100 years. The automaker announced this week that it will pour $200 million into a data center in Michigan that will support its connected vehicle and mobile investments. Ford expects its own data usage to increase by 1,000% over the next several years as the company collects more and more information from its fleet of connected vehicles. All that data needs to be collected, analyzed, and stored, and then resent back to the vehicle. This means building a data center with cloud capabilities is a necessary investment even for an automaker. For car makers such as Ford, the issue is whether it will partner with technology companies to produce this new generation of connected cars or strike out on its own and essentially transform itself into a technology company, which means that its competition is as much Google as it is General Motors. In recent weeks, Microsoft announced that it would open its patent portfolio to automakers to supply the company's technologies to connected cars and autonomous vehicles. Toyota was the first to sign up. But no matter what path it drives down, Ford is now a technology company and one where the cloud is key to its future success.
Apple wants to encourage you to build more apps by giving you a support system to do so. This past week, Apple opened their first app accelerator and chose to build it in Bangalore, India first. There are several motivations behind this new program. They might have some hidden agendas in there as well. The accelerators, in this case, are usually done to promote development on a platform. But as you know, iOS is a pretty popular platform, even though for most enthusiasts and for startups alike. What this program will do, though, likely, is a couple things. One, it'll look to try to increase the iOS usage in the region, in many regions, gaining market share due to the steady decline of mobile manufacturers in China. As well, it will also look to raise the bar and barrier of entry of quality of the apps that make into the store. Apple will provide resources to have their app reviewed by Apple engineers, as well as one-on-one meetings with engineers, and will provide feedback, best practices, and tools. If the program works, Apple is looking at to start more of these programs globally as they continue to grow the platform and the market share. Let's just hope the program doesn't produce more reliable fart applications and add some value and innovation to the platform as well.
In a stunning and yet sadly totally expected reversal of data privacy rules, 265 Republican members of Congress voted, under the banner of allowing for consumer choice, to discharge ISPs from the requirement of asking you before they sell your personal information, including browsing history, age, ethnicity, internet usage pattern, location, and payment history to third parties, or informing you that they've done it after the fact. So, what now? VPN, Tor, proxies, finally answering the call to encrypt everything? Well, that's progress, but before you dust off your VPN client, it's time to take a complete view of your traffic's route, especially if you plan to use open proxies. Austria-based security researcher Christian Haschek analyzed 443 open proxies and found that the vast majority are shady. 79% forbade encrypted traffic, while others directly manipulated site traffic, including image swaps, HTML rewrites, and JavaScript package replacements. Haschek released a tool called Proxy Checker, which will evaluate a proxy for such shady dealings. Unfortunately, all the potential solutions will slow connections and merely shift traffic from one node to another, so a secure internet experience in this new political reality may require you, the user, to be more aware of exactly where your traffic is going. That does it for the blips. Next up, it's the bites. And, well, we wanted to stay away from it, but we have to talk about the major privacy story of the week. But first, let's take a moment to thank a sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, this episode of TWiET is brought to you by GoCD. It's the on-premise open-source continuous delivery server created by ThoughtWorks that is the easiest way to model complex workflows across multiple teams with ease. GoCD understands the difficulty of deployment in a 24/7 environment that demands the five nines of uptime even as real-time deployment is expected. That's why they've built their delivery server to give you comprehensive pipeline modeling, easy-to-configure dependencies for fast feedback, and on-demand deployment with parallel and sequential execution. Of course, if you've worked in development, you know that it's not just about what a tool does, but what it doesn't do. Specifically, GoCD avoids spurious builds by giving you fan-in, fan-out dependency management, so you're never wasting time with an unneeded build. The value stream map lets you track a change from commit to deploy at a glance. And GoCD's real power is in the visibility that it provides over your end-to-end workflow. So you get complete control of and visibility into all your deployments across the organization. They also offer complete customization for your software's individual needs. GoCD will perform tests written in most languages or frameworks, and their test reporting is so good, so thorough, that it won't just tell you that your build failed a test. It will tell you exactly where and in which change set and on which platform a test started breaking. You can compare content across any two arbitrary builds, making it invaluable when troubleshooting a broken pipeline. GoCD is also fantastically flexible. It supports audible deployment. It lets you delegate the configuration of pipelines to users without full-blown admin privileges, which means not everything falls on you. And it has extension points that let you connect any of a number of ready plugins or plugins that you write yourself. The TLDR is this. Say goodbye to deployment panic and hello to consistent, predictable deliveries. GoCD is an open-source server that you can download and use for free. Discover the power of their pipelines at gocd.io/twit. That's gocd.io/twit. Commercial support and enterprise add-ons, including disaster recovery, are also available. And we thank GoCD for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Gentlemen, I know we covered this last week, and I was kind of hoping that it would be another week or two before we'd have to come back. But alas, that's not what happened. Here's what we know. This past Tuesday, the House of Representatives passed a bill that rolled back 2016 FCC privacy rules. Now, of course, the week before, the Senate did the exact same thing, and this was entirely across party lines. So you had the Democrats against it, you had the Republicans for it. The rules that they rolled back included several components that spelled out exactly what users could expect from ISPs in terms of their privacy. For example, opt-in permissions to share web browsing history, geolocation, and financial data with third parties. The rules also stopped ISPs from sharing information about age, gender, and ethnicity. Now, the bill is now headed to Donald Trump's desk, and he has already pledged signing it, of course, under the banner of consumer choice, saying that it was about time that we level the playing field on the internet because companies like Google and Facebook and Microsoft don't operate under the same privacy rules that ISPs like Verizon, Sprint, and Comcast do. The most vocal critic of the rules when they came out last October was then commissioner, now chairman, Ajit Pai. He was the one who first started calling this corporate favoritism, saying that we are giving more power to companies like Google and social media sites than we are to the telcos who actually connect us. His argument then is now the one that was being used by senators and representatives now to justify this. Now, gentlemen, I think we made our feelings pretty clear last week when we said that this was a huge corporate sellout, that there is very, very little way for you to actually say that this is for consumer choice. But now it looks like this is going to be law. This is going to happen. Donald Trump will sign this. What does this mean for the telcos? So let's step back and assume that there's no rubbing of hands, there's no twirling of mustaches. What can Verizon and Sprint and Comcast and AT&T now do with that data that they could not do before? Curtis, let's start with you.
Well, I think the big thing that's important to note is that the rules that were scrapped never went into force. So at a practical level, the question of what they can do now that they couldn't do before is nothing, because the rules never stopped them from doing anything. Having looked at this a little bit more closely and heard some of my journalistic brethren who live up in the D.C. area take a look at it, I think that one of the things this does for the telcos is remove one source of uncertainty. Because prior to this, you had the FCC that had stepped in and said that they were going to regulate individual consumer privacy. And you also had the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, which had been in many ways explicitly authorized to do just that. And so I think that a lot of these ISPs were concerned that at some point they would get some dueling regulations out of the FTC and FCC, and then you would have to go through all sorts of court stuff to figure it out. So while the practical effect on consumers today is nothing at all, in the future, there is at least the hope that the FTC will step in and do some regulation. Barring that, there is a ton of aggregation and targeting of ads and services that will make the kind of ads we've become used to from our Google searches and Facebook activities seem like broad scattershots in the dark in comparison.
Right. And of course, we did bring up the FTC last week. And yes, on the surface, it does sound like the FTC is a better place to handle this. Unfortunately, because of the charter of the FTC can't bring up broad-ranging rules like the FCC can. So if you have a complaint, you have a complaint. You as an individual user, you have to bring a complaint to the FTC. You can't say on behalf of the 2 million people who are going to be affected in the state by this policy, you have to do something. That's an incredible logjam. I mean, if you're talking about efficiency of government, you've just gone for the route that is 1,000 times more inefficient. And I think that's, you know, that's kind of what the people who looked at that part of the decision said, no, that's bogus. That's just justification that doesn't actually exist. Lou, let me throw it over to you because there's a fun side to this. I mean, yes, we are losing privacy that we could have had in the future, but at the same time, we've got certain entities on the internet, some trustworthy, some not, saying, okay, well, if this passes, doesn't this mean that we can band together and buy the browsing history of Congress? That's not actually how this is going to work, right? I mean, I can't say, hey, Verizon, I want just the browsing information for Lou Maresca.
I mean, I think most of these companies are saying, hey, we're going to, you know, de-identify, you know, remove the information that can basically target particular people. And I think, you know, that doesn't prevent them from not doing that, though. I think at this point, I mean, most companies, like, for instance, Comcast took their opportunity to kind of come out of the woodwork and say, you know what, you know, we're going to be good. We're not going to actually sell this personal information, your browser history. But what they didn't say is we might sell your you know, what they didn't say is maybe they'll sell your location information or some other things, but they won't sell your browser history. And the same thing with Verizon. I mean, they have several programs that come along that, you know, are at, like Curtis pointed out, there are advertising based, and they need demographic information and other things. That's, to me, almost identifiable information about your person. And it could come from things like browser history and other things. And then you have AT&T. Of course, they have rules against selling privacy information, private data about customers. But again, I think that all of them don't say, hey, we're not going to use particular or sell particular types of data. I think Kurt Chiebert talked about it last week. Location information is one of those things, right? I mean, they might not be identifiable, but if they can say this particular demographic is in this part of the state or this part of your city, and we should target ads for this particular type of thing, I mean, it becomes almost an invasion. And, I think there's going to be some fine lines. I think there's going to need to be more regulation around this, or it's going to be a slippery slope and they're just going to hide behind particular things that they're not doing when they are doing other things.
Right. And some privacy groups have said, look, we don't think ISPs are going to wholesale use this in the worst possible interpretation. They're going to try to anonymize the data, because what they want to do is they want to sell data sets. They don't want to sell data on particular individuals. No retailer wants to know how X person is buying. They want to know how demographic X is buying. So give us the data set for those between 30 and 35 who make between this and this much, who are male, who live in the northwest of the country. That's a typical data set that is usable for commerce. However, and Curtis, I got to go back to you on this, because there is another part to this, and it does sound like tinfoil hat wearing stuff, but it absolutely makes sense. There is a really big customer who would love this decision, and that's law enforcement. Because if you do this, and if you do make it possible for me to buy any data from ISPs, then law enforcement suddenly has the ability to search data without a warrant.
Oh, absolutely, because they can just go in and buy the data without, as you say, having to have a warrant. So I think that there are probably a whole bunch of Fourth Amendment cases that are going to be coming out with this. It's going to be very interesting to see just which pieces of data the carriers decide are economically worth selling, because not every piece is. And, as you point out, not only is it unlikely that they're going to drill down and sell, my personal information as a one-off, it's not really economically advantageous for them to do that, because they would have to realistically charge somewhere in the four or five figures to make it worth them while for them to go through the system and pull it out. And this is all about economics. Let's remember that this is something that's a boon to the ISPs and their real customers, and those real customers are the other businesses out there. So I think what we're going to see is a lot of metadata aggregation, a lot of law enforcement and other sort of unintended consequences coming into the scenario. And even though this is not what anyone on the congressional side wanted, a lot of uncertainty for at least the next 18 to 24 months as different companies try to sort this out and realistically at least a handful of lawsuits work their way through the courts.
We've got Emily the Strange in our chat room, who is a longtime a member of the Twilight Riot. She makes a great point. She says, okay, she's not all that concerned about what they might sell to a retailer. She's not even concerned what they might be collecting against her for law enforcement. She's worried that data gets sold to an entity that doesn't protect it. And you don't have to go very far. It was just a couple of weeks ago that the Secret Service lost a laptop that was left on a car seat that contained confidential information about Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, and Pope Francis. So, I mean, that's the thing. Even if you trust the organizations to buy it with good intent, once you let it out, you can't trust that those organizations are going to store it properly. Now, okay, let's kind of evolve this, because this is not just a one-note story. States like California already have laws that restrict government access to data online. So even with this federal decision, law enforcement in California does not have complete warrantless, unrestricted access to data. And there are other states that are considering this, like Illinois. Illinois has a right to privacy piece of legislation that is currently moving through their house. Now, this does add a little wrinkle, because now that the federal government has said that the FCC is not going to enforce any sort of data privacy on the federal level, you've got states that are stepping in and saying, well, we're going to do it on the local level. And if the administration wanted to remove regulation and they thought that it was too difficult to have one major policy that oversaw data privacy in the country, just wait until they have 50 different policies that ISPs now have to navigate. The idea that state legislatures could nullify the U.S. Congress's decision is actually, it's in process right now. Right after, just a few hours after the House sent the bill to the president's desk, the Minnesota House of Representatives introduced legislation that adopts the most important parts of the 2016 FCC rules on privacy. ISPs would be required to get written, not just an opt-in, but written permission from users before they could sell data to a third party. This was a Democrat-introduced amendment to the budget bill that Republicans tried to block on a procedural vote. However, Republican Senator Warren Leamer crossed the aisle to block the procedural play. That meant that the amendment did make it onto the floor for a vote. And once it was on the floor, it was passed by a vote of 66-1. Now, this is an interesting note, because the Republicans didn't vote against it, except for one, and he voted against it. He justified saying we need to study this more, because they knew that voting against consumer privacy was a vote that was going to haunt them in coming elections. Instead, they tried to tie up the amendment in a procedural vote. This all tells me that they understand that this is in no way a consumer-friendly removal of rules. The rules are good for consumers, and they didn't want to be that representative who voted against them. This gives me hope that in even a state that is dominated by Republican lawmakers, they recognize the importance of this. Lou, what do you think about this? Is this going to be repeated? Are we going to get 50 instances of states saying, well, if the FCC is not going to do it, we are?
Absolutely. I mean, you kind of see that. You'll have some states that will come along and they'll say, you know what, we're going to do, you know, something different, and we're going to change the regulations. But you'll definitely get states that are coming along, especially depending on party, that will say, hey, well, we're not going to regulate this because we're just going to follow suit. And I think it's all going to be dependent on, you know, there's multiple layers here in the political system. And I think it's all going to depend on that, as well as, you know, if you get these rogue states that are going to say, you know what, we're going to try to change something here and maybe force regulation at the state level, and see maybe if at some point the feds will kind of copy and come along. So, it's all just time will tell at this point.
Right, right. Now, Curtis, something else here, which is the fact that well, if you start implementing this state by state by state, can it actually work? Because the internet doesn't obey state lines. So it's not as if you can have a really strict policy in California and a really a permissive policy in Nevada and expect that ISPs are going to get exactly right when data is transiting.
Yeah, and I frankly think that this quilt of state regulations is probably the surest way to have Congress step in and make some very explicit rules. And I think we can pretty much guarantee that those explicit rules will be things that no consumer likes. So while I understand the urge for state legislators to try to come in and protect their citizens, I think this is one of those things where the best thing to do would be for state officials to lobby the FTC and other federal regulators to try and get some cooperation so that we can get a uniform federal law, a national set of regulations that makes sense in protecting our individual information while still, you know, allowing at least the level of commerce that has taken place so far to continue to occur.
Right. Lou, let me throw this back over to you, because, again, we have not heard the end of this. This is most likely going to become law of the land. They will roll back those protections. And the way that they're doing it is very difficult to reverse. So even if you were to have a new administration in a couple of years, it wouldn't be easy for the FCC to do these rules again, because essentially what Congress has done is to say the FCC didn't have the ability to pass these rules in the first place. That actually does mean something. Can you get enough consensus at the state level to at least have a baseline of data protection to say, look, we all agree that there must be an opt-in, and we all agree that you must share with your customers when you're selling their data?
I think so. I think there's, you know, you got to remember businesses have a regulated at different levels across the United States in different states. I mean, there's laws against, you know, people opting in and opting out of things, especially in California. And, you know, companies have to follow these rules, you know, on a state by state basis. So I think that if states start to adapt these things, you will start to get, you know, companies having to second guess what they're doing, where the data is coming from, where the customer is geolocated. And, you know, if they have the right to actually get that data or not. Now, we'll be able to be regulated. You know, that's the tough part, right? I mean, as an ISP, you know, who's watching that, right? I mean, you know, can they get caught at some point if they're doing it wrong? Maybe not. You know, I guess that's the problem is you can do it at the state level, but will it actually happen? I'm sure that corporations say that it's happening. But again, these programs take a long time to implement and take away. So I think it all depends, you know, if it can be regulated or not and monitored. And I don't think it can. So I think there's a lot of things that are going wrong. And I think there's not enough people paying attention.
Indeed. All right. Well, gentlemen, I think that's enough time on data privacy. We will have to come back at some point in the near future. I don't see this issue going away anytime soon. But for now, let's put it to bed. And instead, talk about something wonderful. And that thing that's wonderful is bringing a guest onto the show. You know, this is my favorite part. It's when we get to bring someone in from the outside, an expert, a guru who can drop some knowledge on the Twilight Ride. And today, we are absolutely graced with the presence of Mr. Birut Sheth. He is the CEO of Gupshup, which is, it's a company that specializes in bots. Birut, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you, Padre. Thanks for having me.
Now, can you tell us, I understand that the name of your company means chit-chat in Hindi, which is absolutely appropriate. What does Gupshup or Gupshup?
Gupshup.
What does Gupshup do?
So Gupshup is a bot platform. It's the quickest and easiest way to make advanced bots. And we provide all the tools and the capabilities that developers need to make intelligent bots, you know, quickly and easily.
Right. And actually, at Enterprise Connect, where Curtis and I just came back from, bots were a hot topic because it is one of the best ways to make sure that you have immediate interaction with whoever you need to have immediate interaction with. It might be your customers. It might be your clients. Tell me, what would be the difference between what you would consider a bot, maybe a first generation bot and a next generation bot?
Well, I think let's back up for a second, right? To me, bots represent a wholesale sort of platform shift or a paradigm shift, right? Every decade or so, the very way in which we use software or use computers changes. In the mid-80s, it was primarily desktop. In the mid-90s, it was sort of the browser and website model. In the mid-2000s, it became smartphone and mobile app model. And now we are moving to this new paradigm where it's all about messaging and chatbots, right? So bots are these software programs that can communicate you, converse with you through a messaging app. And when I say messaging, I mean it could be text, it could be voice, either way, right? So I think to me, if you look at it that way, right, just like you have millions of websites and millions of apps, you're going to have millions of bots. And yes, there are going to be simple bots and more advanced bots, just like you see websites, right? There are simple template sort of plug-and-play websites, and then there are more advanced e-commerce websites, let's say. So in the same way, you know, you're going to have a whole spectrum of bots. On the low end, they may be very simple and straightforward. They answer a handful of questions and you're good. But a more advanced bot might be something you can actually have a conversation about the philosophy of life, perhaps, right? So it can be more interactive, more intelligent, more personalized, more conversational, and so on. But I think to me, the big thing is the fact that you don't have to there's no downloads, right? So you sort of bypass that problem. People hate to download too many apps on their mobile devices. You can instantly converse. And even if it's a simple, if it's a pizza ordering app, I mean, it may be good enough, right? So long as I can order the pizza without having to download a new app, that's good enough for me. It doesn't need to be very advanced. It just needs to be good at what it does.
Your company definitely has the lineage for this. You've got over 30,000 developers. You handle over 4 billion messages per month, which means you get a nice data set. You get to see sort of what is happening, what's changed about the market for bots. Can you tell us a little bit about the end-to-end life cycle of a bot? When a client starts developing a bot, typically what do they look at? How do they design the capabilities? And when do they know when it's time to replace it?
Yeah, I think, just like developing, let's say, a website or an app, similarly, the sort of a development life cycle of a bot. Firstly, of course, is the scope, right? What is the problem you're trying to solve? What are you trying to address? The next thing then is you sort of have to, because bots have a conversational interface, you need to develop a script for it, the dialogues and the queries it's going to respond to and its capabilities. And then you get into some of the usual things around, designing, architecting, development and testing. And even testing has to be inside all the messaging apps that you're going to use it with, right? Whether it's Facebook Messenger, Slack, Skype, or it could be Amazon Alexa, Google Home, and so on. And further down, you need tools to manage the bot, right? Monitoring it so that it's always on, analytics. And even the analytical aspect is very different, right? Because how do you analyze conversations, which is different from analyzing, click path and so on. So it's sort of, and then the whole cycle repeats, of course, right? As you analyze and you get data, you need to refine it, right? What are the queries that people are asking, that users are asking? What can it answer? And what additional features do you need to add to it? Now, even in this whole cycle, by the way, you may add more advanced things like NLP, AI, so it can get very, very complex. It's easy to get started, but of course, the more advanced bots can take a lot of time.
Right. Okay, so that's what we think of typically when we think of a bot. We think of conversational bots. We think of customer service bots. Mm-hmm. You've got something a little different. You've got Interbot, which is bot-to-bot conversation. Can you explain what that is and why would I want that?
Great question. So far, let's just look back over the last 12 months or so, right, where suddenly the interest in bots has dramatically grown. And I think, since Facebook announced it at its F8 conference, I think there's been a lot of developers working on building bots and so on. And all the conversation so far has focused around the bot-to-human interaction, right? How do bots and humans converse? But very quickly, right? So we've had tens of thousands of developers building bots on our platform, looking at advanced use cases. And we're suddenly seeing the need that as more and more advanced bots come in, you need these bots to have the ability to talk to each other, right? So let me give you a few use cases first, right? Imagine if you could that you might want your Uber bot to talk to your Starbucks bot to have your coffee ready by the time your car arrives, right? Or you might want your shopping bot to go talk to all the merchant bots to do comparison shopping, right? Or even in enterprises, many companies, they build a lot of different bots. And what they find is that, every department, every division, every geography needs to build their own bot, but they can't go to market with like a dozen brands, right? So they create sort of one customer-facing brand bot that just acts like a router. It redirects queries to the underlying botlets, so to speak. So there's many different examples where you very quickly get to this scenario of bots needing to interact with each other. It allows bots to be able to, essentially a bot can get help from other bots to provide additional services that it may not be capable of. And one last thing I'll mention is even in terms of developing bots, right, Interbot makes sort of bot development much easier. Think about the following, right? I could take a translate bot, a NLP bot, and a simple pizza bot, and simply by stringing them together in sequence, I could have a multilingual intelligent pizza bot, right? And it's literally as simple as that. It's like putting together, it's plug and play, right? You're sort of putting Lego blocks together essentially to create something cool and new. So I think the possibilities are endless. We've barely scratched the surface, but I do believe that this is going to be sort of the next phase two of the bot phenomena.
I tell you, you haven't lived until you've had a bot order pizza for you in Hindi.
Exactly right.
Now, it's interesting because I think this should be understandable to our audience, because when we think about digital assistants, we think of something, okay, it's getting closer to Jarvis from the movie Iron Man. We want a digital assistant that can do everything for us. This is a mm-hmm. different way of looking at this. This is saying, look, you don't need one massive artificial intelligence. You need little bots that control very narrow aspects of either your life or your business's life, and they do the best thing for their particular area of responsibility. Now, if I can connect them, if I can make them talk to each other, then I should be able to develop something that approximates a very large artificial intelligence, but does so much more faithfully to the individual components. And of course, in order for this to happen, there has to be a common language. What's the common language of a bot? Tell me about this Innerbot API. How do I make bot A talk to bot B, talk to bots C through double X?
Sure. So firstly, just to address the earlier point you made, you're absolutely right, right? The way to build advanced complex systems is really to break it into modular parts. In fact, think about how humans behave, right? Instead of having one giant super intelligent human, I mean, here, the way our species has evolved is everybody has their own respective intelligence that comes together and we do, you know, and we achieve amazing things. I think in the same way, it becomes a lot easier to have each bot doing its own specific localized thing, but connecting them to bring this connected consciousness or the collective mind together, if you will. So we just launched, we've soft launched a couple of weeks ago, this thing called Interbot. Interbot is a communication channel, right, that you can look at interbot.cc. Now, the key insight is think of it just like a communication channel such as Facebook Messenger or Slack or Telegram. While those other channels are for humans to talk to other humans or for humans to talk to bots, Interbot is a channel for bots to talk to other bots, right? And just like any other channel, a bot would publish itself so that it's accessible to other bots, and then it can consume other bots as well. But once it's connected to this communication channel, it's really, messages flow from one to the other. They can just address each other, send a message. And if you compare, you know, many of your many developers would wonder, saying, well, wait a minute, we already have APIs. Why do we need bot-to-bot communication? And I think to me, bots sort of take this metaphor to a higher level, right? APIs are generally synchronous. Bots are asynchronous, right? You have APIs are unidirectional. It's just request response. Bots can be bidirectional. APIs are very, they're flaky, as in if you miss a parameter, it can just break. While bots tend to be more robust, they are conversational. If you miss a parameter, it'll ask you to provide that in response. And what we've done with Interbot.cc is sort of not put in sort of very strong restrictions on what kind of messages can pass through. So it doesn't have to be, you know, it could be, but doesn't have to be a JSON payload. It could be plain text. So in fact, if you're looking at this video here, these are Interbot messages that are literally just plain text messages flowing from one to the other, right? I think the key insight is we want to take existing bots, right, the tens of thousands or millions of bots that are going to be created, and make it such that with practically zero code change, you could just take the bot, put it on Interbot, and now it's connected to this wide world of bots. Yeah.
Berudi, in your mind, what makes a bot successful? I mean, we can all design bots. There are APIs out there and toolkits that we can create a bot. But what makes just a bot for fun's sake different from a bot that actually does something that's useful?
You know, the first and foremost thing is just identifying the scope and setting the right expectation. Right? Suppose it's a music bot and it can play any song. It may be just one thing, but it can be very delightful because it's something that people need. Or if it's like the stereotypical pizza bot or a specific e-commerce bot, right? So to me, it's a successful bot doesn't have to be super ambitious in terms of what it does. It just needs to be clear about what it does and fulfill that capability very, very well, right? I mean, that's what users expect, because a lot of this, you know, when you think about the hype cycle, you think about people getting disillusioned with bots, that usually happens because a bot is not clear about what it can or cannot do. And this is not unlike how humans behave with each other, right? In the workplace, I mean, you take on responsibilities and set the right expectation that I'll deliver it by so-and-so time. And if you deliver it, people are happy. It's kind of the same thing here with bots as well. So I think to me, it's a misnomer to correlate it to advanced or super advanced capability. It should just do what it says and say what it does very, very clearly. And it could be simple stuff, but it's convenient. And it's convenient because, you know, I don't have to open the browser or download a new app. I could be in my Slack or in my Facebook Messenger, and just as I'm chatting with friends, I could send a quick query and it comes back, and that's the end of it, right? So it's already set up for success in the sense that it bypasses the download barrier. It's in your favorite messaging app, so users don't have to go anywhere. So the next step beyond that, bot developers should just focus on, like I said, just clear scope and clear expectations.
We've got an active chat room here, and they're true to form. They're asking some pretty good questions. You've got Emily the Strains and Kylie Lu and CR1 PC Guy who are all asking about, well, is it a good idea to have bots talking to bots? Is it a good idea to have bots able to influence other bots? I mean, yes. Okay, let's not get into the rise of Skynet here, but is there something to regulate what information bots will pass along? How do we make sure that when I design my bots and then let my bot loose into a world with other bots interacting with other businesses and other individuals, that my bot won't do something that's going to put me and my data security at jeopardy?
Oh, of course. I mean, I think, look, we are, you know, this is literally the first marker we've laid down, right? Arguably, when we talked about connecting websites, that was a scary idea, right? What if content goes from one website to another? And then, of course, hyperlink is revolutionary and the rest is history, right? So there is a right way to do it. And we need to make sure we do the right things, but not the wrong things. For example, how does one bot trust another bot? Well, guess what, right? So just as you have thousands of bots emerging, you're going to have a whole infrastructure, a security infrastructure that'll have to emerge. So you need trust and verification, you need payment and escrow, you need reputation and reviews. And by the way, arguably, these would be provided by bots themselves, right? If you think about the early days of the web, there were these services like Trusty and Thoughty and VeriSign that really certified websites, right? Here's a website where you can submit a credit card because it has the right terms and conditions, the policies. It's not a fly-by-night operator. Somebody called and verified that they are who they say they are, right? So similarly, you're going to have to do that with the bot ecosystem. So let's start with that first, right? So you need to know which bots are trustworthy, which ones are not. Then even when they're exchanging some service and paying for each other, you know, some trusted bot is going to provide payment in escrow so that if there's a dispute or a problem, you can unwind the transaction perhaps. Then of course, data ownership, right? If a user gives his data to one bot, is that bot allowed to pass it to the next one or the third one and so on, right? So of course there's, you know, potential for abuse, and we need to have safeguards. You need to architect the platform to prevent that, and we are doing that. We're working with a lot of players in the ecosystem to enable that. But that doesn't, you know, but if you talk about connecting stuff, I mean, that's been the holy grail of computer science from day one, right? We wanted to connect computers. I mean, that's the internet. We wanted to connect content. Well, that's the web as we know it. And now this is the next step up. You're actually connecting active live software, you know, perhaps even autonomous software for the first time. And I think the opportunities, the possibilities are endless. Of course, the risks are higher too. And I think we'll work through them as an ecosystem. We'll all have to work through it, right? So the right question is, how do we do it the right way, not whether we do it at all?
I could just see on my personal list of bots, my health bot will be overriding the decision of my pizza bot, which will be arguing with my gym bot. But yeah, it's interesting to see how they're going to interact. But one thing that started popping up in the back of my mind, are we asking for a bot arms race here? Because I mean, I can see bots being incredibly useful. They're already incredibly useful. They are in use on the internet right now. There are use in every network I touch. But I could see generations of bots being developed to take advantage of known weaknesses of other bots. For example, if I write a bot that finds me the best price for travel, then maybe the travel company comes up with a bot that tries to recognize my bot to give that bot false information so that I don't get the best deal, except unless I order directly from them. And then I'm going to have to write a bot that counters the bot that counters my bot. I mean, at some point, people are going to start realizing that there's a lot of advantage to be had in having the latest bot that is aware of all other existing bots.
Absolutely. In fact, it's even crazier than you think it is, right? Today, when we talk about software development and advancement and arms race, right, all technology generally is built by developers, right? So one developer builds something, somebody else builds something else, and so on. But the interesting thing about Interbot, right, is that bots can actually upgrade themselves autonomously, right? Think about this example I mentioned earlier where you have a translate bot and an NLP bot and a pizza bot, and suddenly that says, you know what, there's a new translate tool. So instead of pointing to this one, I'm going to point to the other translate tool, and suddenly now it can handle 10 more languages, right? So you have bots upgrading themselves, or you'll have bots replicating themselves. You could have bots creating other bots as well, right? So you no longer are just, you know, you're no longer operating at developer pace. You're operating at software pace, right? So the innovation cycles are going to be much faster, much shorter, and it's crazy, right? But at the same time, I'm not pessimistic. I'm very optimistic in terms of the potential, right? I think to me, philosophically, the best thing, the key insight was this whole blockchain thing, if you think about it, right? You always have good people, you have bad people. You always have good bots and bad bots. But so long as you have more good people than bad people, our species will survive. And same thing, similarly, so long as you have more good bots than bad bots, the bot civilization will survive and make progress, right? So that's how, in spite of our wars, I think human beings are still around and generally okay. So I think that's the way I like to think about it. Yes, it's going to be an arms race, but by and large, you know, bots are going to be infused with human values, I think, because a lot of people are talking about it, a lot of developers are thinking about it. So even as some bad guys are thinking about how to build bad bots, I think I'm confident that there are going to be more good people driving this.
I don't know, the idea of bots writing bots, and then at some point those bots are going to find a CNC machine in the real world, and then it's all over. I want to bring in my co-host here because they've been chomping at the bit to get in on this. Curtis, you had a couple of interesting observations about a bot-on-bot world.
Well, yeah, and especially as we start talking about things like the bots riding bots, I think a question that becomes huge is, to what extent do bots represent a new attack vector and a new way of, as you say, these bad people who we hope exist in smaller quantities than good people, but still exist, give them a way to get into our systems and get into our processes in ways that our security systems at this point aren't able to cope with, especially if they start doing it at very high frequency and very high speed.
Well, there's, like I said, I mean, there's no doubt that the risks, there are going to be risks. There's risks with the internet as well. In fact, as we saw with the election, in fact. So I think that the same mechanism also gives you better defensive mechanisms, right? Imagine, I think one of the challenges I find today, when I think about internet and securing our networks and so on, it's literally each company or each community has to sort of protect their own set of computers. And if they don't have enough, enough operations specialists or security specialists, they may not have best practices yet, right? I think the way I think about bots is that because it makes it all frictionless, imagine if one security genius builds a high quality secure bot, it can help literally every other bot protect itself, right? So suddenly, I mean, it amplifies the capabilities of security professionals in helping others, right? So if you remember earlier on, I mentioned there is a trust and reputation bot which says, okay, here are the verified ones, here are the unverified ones, here are the certified ones versus here are the ones that aren't. And if you sort of stay within this ecosystem of certified bots, then it kind of protects you, and in some ways it's easier to protect yourself because it's easier to connect, right? So to me, of course, all progress in technology will lead to good and bad use cases, but I think that's not an argument against progress. It's really just we just had to figure out how to do it the right way, And everybody's thinking about doing exactly that. Yeah.
Lou, let me pull you into the conversation because I know that you had a couple of, interests in this machine-to-machine, bot-to-bot communication.
Yeah, absolutely. So one thing interesting about this, and I wish I could go back and start using my whiteboard, but it's one of those questions you tend to ask people in interviews. It's like, you know, there's a whole concept of the cascading effect, you know, where, you know, you are importing your own custom bots into the system and other people are importing custom bots and then you're communicating to each bot. And you almost have this tree-like structure where, you know, a bot will communicate mm-hmm. to a bot, will communicate to a bot, and it kind of all the way down the structure. And I'm not sure. Is there a way to secure that? I mean, what prevents people from not securing that and also adding latency into the system and so on? And then my second part of the question is, you know, what kind of advantage over that versus somebody going to a large service like, for instance, for natural language processing or some services that are being offered from these cloud giants that kind of offer similar things, but with a little bit more security, a little bit more reliability from that perspective?
Sure. So, actually, I'll take the second question first. In fact, we are already talking to some of the big technology giant companies, right? So imagine if somebody has an NLP bot or an AI bot with certain capabilities, and today they just offer APIs, which means developers have to integrate those APIs into their bots and do some interesting things. But imagine if it was just a bot on this Interbot platform. And, you know, if your team can queue up this demo 2 video that shows exactly an example of that. But as you'd expect, right, imagine whether it's IBM Watson or Microsoft Bing or other Google and Amazon services, if they were available on Interbot, it makes it easy for developers to do that, right? So if you look at this video example here, I mean, it's literally... You know, it's composing a video. I mean, it's composing a new bot simply by putting an NLP bot in sequence with an e-commerce bot, and it makes it really, really easy. So the idea here is, I expect the best and the brightest bots that are out there, the best services out there, enterprise-grade services from big, respectable companies, also being put here along with all the startup and developers creating bots. Right. So it actually opens up a whole new phenomena where people are going to build bots, not just for humans, but for other bots. Right. So it's no different than, you know, I often joke that the microbot architecture is going to be the new version of microservice architecture. Right. So instead of offering microservice APIs, you just offer them as little utility bots that are easier to plug and play and do interesting things with. And, you know, and then to your earlier question about, if you have this complex graph or tree of interconnectivity across lots and lots of bots, I think it's no different from, in the old days, we used to produce code libraries. And today, let's say you might do a node module. Tomorrow, I'm proposing that we just build them as bots, right? So most coding, most software uses ton and ton of libraries that are built into the operating system or even other third-party libraries and so on. So there's nothing new here in the sense that we've always used building blocks. And, you know, the way to stand tall is to stand on the shoulders of giants, right? So you leverage what other people have done. You don't reinvent the wheel every time you're doing something. You just plug it in. All I'm saying is the Interbot mechanism makes it much, much easier to do that than sort of doing it through at the code library level or even at an API level.
But I don't think there's any question that this is going to become useful. This is going to become popular. It's already on its way. I think we are going to get to the point where it's just not going to be worth it not to have at least a few bots searching through your daily activities and your daily encounters with other bots, not to have them. But where do you see this over the next year? What are the industries that are going to be most affected by this? Which industries will be the quickest to adopt it? And which industries are going to be the ones that gain the most advantage from developing their bot art?
Sure. So, in the first wave of bot development, right, we're already seeing verticals such as, let's say, financial services or retail, customer support. These are the areas where people are creating bots, you know, leaving aside consumer categories, e-commerce, of course, and so on. So there's a lot of bots being built to improve the consumer the bots for humans, if you will, the bot-to-human interaction. And the moment you layer on Interbot, right, suddenly it makes it easier to even add utilities and components and so on. So as I look forward to the next 12 months, let's say, you know, I think developers have had ample time to get up the learning curve. They've experimented with the medium and so on, right? So even as the hype cycle has sort of risen and fallen, I think I see we engage with the developer community a lot, and we're seeing a lot of interest and a lot of proficiency that's being developed. So over the next 12 months, I think with platforms such as Interbot, it makes it even easier to build smarter bots, right? Today, by the way, if somebody wants to build a multilingual bot, right, you have to integrate APIs into your own system. It's sort of adding a lot of capabilities. If you want to add NLP and AI, you almost have to become an NLP expert yourself. But with Interbot, it's going to be plug and play, which means, you know, somebody else, maybe an IBM, maybe a Microsoft, maybe some other large companies already doing the work, and you're just plugging into their services very quickly and easily, so that anyone, you know, irrespective of whether they are coders or not, can build advanced bots. So I think I see this inflecting. I see, you know, so today, give or take, there's Facebook would probably say there are 50 to 100,000 bots on their platform. Over the next 12 months, I would expect that to get into the millions because, you know, this is sort of nonlinear growth. And we are also seeing a few bots breaking out, you know, bots that would be thousands of messages, like, say, 3 months ago, but now running in the millions of messages and so on. So I think I see this whole wave sort of rising, lots of bots emerging, people using these new mechanisms to build better and smarter bots. Yeah.
We've been speaking with Biru Chath, the CEO of Gupshup, who possibly has the most advanced bot foo on the planet. Unfortunately, we've done it again. We've used up another hour. Listen to the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. That's according to 9 out of 10 bots. And I'm pretty sure that 10th bot was defective. Biru, I want to thank you for coming on. This is a next-gen topic, and I'm sure we're going to have you back at some point once our audience starts creating their own bots. Could you please let our audience know where they can find you, where they can find Gupshup, where they can find your interface to start creating their own bots?
Sure. So my personal Twitter ID is @Berud. That's @BEERUD, my first name. Our bot platform is at gupshup.io. Very, you know, you can build a bot in less than a minute across any dozens of channels. And then we just launched the Interbot channel, which is a separate brand and product, obviously, because it's a different thing. It's at interbot.cc. Which is an Interbot communication channel. So, you know, please try it out. Irrespective of your coding skills, anybody can build bots. And whether you like it or not, you know, we are all going to have to develop our own bot strategy and such. So bots are coming, and let's get prepared for it.
Thanks again for being part of the Twyatt Riot. And of course, gentlemen, we have to thank our co-hosts, because we wouldn't have Twyatt without them. They are the heart and the soul, the hair of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's start with Lou. Lou, where can people find you? What are you up to? And, you know, why are you going home early today for your son's birthday?
I'm going to go ball next week just so I can stop the hair. Just kidding. Just spending time with my son. He's only turned 4. And you can always find me and my work. Find my stuff on Twitter at LouMM. And, of course, my work here at Microsoft at crm.dynamics.com.
And, of course, we have to thank Curtis Franklin. Curtis Franklin has been with me the longest, aside from Brian Chi, and he is the master of all things executive in the enterprise. Curtis, where can people find you and your work?
Well, right now they can find me at Light Reading. Can also find me at a new site under the Light Reading umbrella. It's called Enterprise Cloud News. I'll have an interview that I did at Enterprise Connect up at Enterprise Cloud News a bit later on today, and still working on a new site that I'll be able to tell everyone about in just a few weeks. But for all of that and more, you can follow me on Twitter. That's at KG4GWA.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for your time, your talent, and your treasure on This Week in Enterprise Tech. And of course, thanks to you, to the person who comes back each and every single week to listen and to watch our episodes. Without you, we couldn't do This Week in Enterprise Tech. We want to make it easier for you to get your enterprise fix each week. Just go to our show page at twit.tv/twiet. That's T-W-I-E-T. There you'll find all of our episodes back to the beginning, so you can find out what we've been talking about each week, as well as links to the stories that we cover on every week's episode. But more importantly, off to the side there, we've got a little menu so you can subscribe to the RSS feed. That means you can get the version of your choice into your device of choice. You can get an audio version in your iPhone. You can get a video version on your tablet. You can get a high-definition video version for your laptop, your desktop, for watching later on and all its glorious high-definition goodness. Again, just go to twit.tv/twiet. Also, don't forget that you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/PadreSJ. If you follow me there, you'll see little clues as to what our future topics are going to be. You'll also be able to suggest topics for future episodes. You'll see all of the toiletries that I take from my hotel room at the Gaylord Palms in Orlando, because they just have the most awesome smelling shampoo ever. It smells like coconuts. Go figure. Again, just go to twitter.com/PadreSJ. Finally, thanks to everyone here who makes this show possible. Of course, to Lisa and Leo, who have allowed us and supported us in Twiet all these years. To Kara and Alex, who are our engineers. They set everything up, make sure that everything is good to go. And to my technical director, Kevin. Kevin, could you let the people know what it is that you do here at Twit TV? Or not?
I press the Kara button and I get food.
Okay.
L-I-T-D.
Yes, this is good. And as always, you get a chance for redemption at the end of every episode by answering a question that comes out of the knowledge that every episode gave you. And this is this week's question. We've been talking a lot about bots, but what is the one thing that all bots are afraid of?
Google.
I'm sorry. That was an easy one. John Connor, the leader of the resistance. Kevin, this was an easy one. I thought this was going to be the week you were going to get redemption. I guess not. We'll try again next week. Until next time, I am Father Robert Ballester, the digital Jesuit, just reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.